From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm producer Megan Mack, alongside host Evan Dawson.
Hello, Megan.
Hello, Evan. This week, we welcomed Noam Chomsky to Connections. The outspoken activist, political dissident, scientist, and linguist came to Rochester for a series of public events.
He talked to us about a range of subjects, including the psychology of climate change. Now, Chomsky has said that he fears the American right, the Republican Party, because it has the actual capacity to endanger our species. And here he is explaining whether he thinks climate deniers are genuine in their disbelief.
We only know what the candidates say. Almost all of them just simply flatly deny that it's happening, or if it's happening, that humans have anything to do with it. One candidate, Kasich, says, yeah, it's happening, but then he goes on to say we shouldn't do anything about it. Well, that's basically, it's almost like a death knell for the species. And it's not anything remote. It's having an impact right now. So, for example, last December, there was an international conference in Paris attempting to achieve an international commitment among the countries of the world to deal with the problem, the dreadful problem of emissions. And they were hoping to achieve a binding treaty, but they couldn't for one reason, the Republican Congress. That was quite explicit. They couldn't achieve a treaty because the Republican Congress would not accept it, a Republican-led Congress. Therefore, they had to settle for voluntary agreements, which are, of course, much weaker. And if a Republican were to be elected, and if they actually mean what they say, then the world is in deep trouble for this reason alone.
I guess, to some degree, the distinction between whether climate change is mythical or knows it's a problem and doesn't care doesn't really matter.
Actually, it comes out the same. If they just believe it's a myth, you can accuse them of astonishing ignorance. If they know it's not a myth and are nevertheless denying it, you can accuse them of real criminality. They're saying, look, we know our policies are going to undermine the prospects for decent survival, but we don't care.
Next, we met the man who founded I'm From Driftwood. It's a website that collects stories from the LGBTQ community around the world, individual stories of coming out and of fighting for inclusion.
Since 2009, I'm From Driftwood has collected stories from all 50 states and many countries. The founder is Nathan Mansky, and he visited Rochester to tell his powerful story of sharing his own experience and then encouraging others to do the same. Nathan told us that his own childhood was a challenge, feeling like the only gay kid in rural Texas.
I had a really great childhood and growing up, but again, it was just the isolation that I felt.
But you said you weren't out in high school.
Right.
But you knew you were gay.
I did, as you know, most people. I mean, I knew I was gay since the second grade when a new boy showed up at school. And I was like, I want to sit next to him. I don't know what that means, but I like Cody. Yep.
But could you have come out in high school, do you think? I mean, of course you could, anybody can, but could you and would it have been just a smooth sort of an upbringing for you?
I honestly think that I could have done it. I mean, now, you know, Facebook has changed everything. I'm friends with so many people from high school I think I definitely could have. I think some people would have respected it, you know, being in a tiny town and doing something as difficult as that. I think that would have, you know, kind of overpowered any other issues that would have come with it. It's like, wow, like this kid in rural Texas just came out as gay. That's impressive. So I went from kindergarten to my senior year. So everyone knew each other. There was, you know, some general bullying, but, you know, like everyone kind of got along and everyone knew me and I had my own close little circle of friends. So I think that I could have. And of course, I look back now and I'm like, man, I should have, like, because I know that all my classmates would have been okay with it. But that's now, you know.
Sure. And so that sense of isolation, feeling like the only gay kid in Texas, was not because you felt like you couldn't come out or people weren't supportive. It was just rural, a big, you know, 40 acres to begin with. And dating's got to be really hard, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably, you know, why I imagine a lot of gay kids in rural areas probably moved to more metropolitan areas, because you probably would like to date at some point, right?
Yeah. I mean, in high school, I had a girlfriend, so that took care of that. But then, you know, once I went to UT in Austin, and that's when I really came out and started dating and, you know, had boyfriends. And, mm-hmm. you know, and now I live in New York City where there's, you know, tons of gay people. But, you know, I don't think my dating life has improved that much in New York. So, you know, who knows? I don't know.
Well, I can just throw in that we still hear from a lot of kids in sort of the rural areas around here. You know, we hear very similar tales that still exist. Now, the big difference, of course, is, you know, you talk about Ellen coming out as sort of part of your process. There's so much more visibility, and the internet and phones and all that kind of stuff have increased visibility, but it hasn't necessarily made it easier to come out. I spoke to actually a teacher today from Mount Morris, New York, who called me this morning about starting a GSA down there. And, you know, she actually was doing it because she has a kid in her school who has two moms. And one of the kids asked for a way to connect with other kids who would be welcoming and be okay with somebody having two moms. So there's still a sense of isolation. It's very different from what Nathan experienced, very different from what I had experienced, you know, 20 years prior to that.
Let's turn now to a subject that has caught fire across the country in the last week. The Tampa Bay Times published a kind of agricultural expose.
The Times investigated dozens of Florida restaurants that claimed to offer local food or farm-to-table meals. And they found that most restaurants are lying to customers when they say this. Many are flying in food from hundreds or thousands of miles away and passing it off as local.
In this clip, you'll hear first from Jerry Serafine, owner of Restaurant Tuvine, and then from Art Rogers of Lento. Their message is clear. Restaurants must be transparent with customers.
I was shocked that these restaurants thought that they could get away with this to that extent.
Because, in other words, you're going to get caught eventually, yes?
Yeah, and some of these restaurants weren't being called out because they had one or two items that sort of slipped through the cracks. They were being called out on their entire menu as being fake. And to me, it was like, what were you thinking?
You know local suppliers, produce, growers, et cetera. You've got good relationships with them. Have they ever complained? You don't have to name names, but have they ever complained to you that this is happening in Rochester?
Sure. Two of my farmers, when I told them I was coming on the show and what the theme was, said, oh, yeah, that's happened to me. And I had to walk into the restaurant and confront the chef or owner. And similar to what she was saying, oh, we got a sample or we had a small amount and then we just never changed the menu, something to that effect. And the farmer's like, well, take my name off your menu or start buying my stuff. And in every case, they did have to take their name off the menu. But so, yeah, it's happened.
Art and Jerry may agree with Laura's take and the farmer's take that she talked to, that is theft. That is also, I think, Art, if you are trying to compete, and you are in Rochester, by, you know, Art's restaurant Lento focuses more on local than many others. But again, he's not saying everything is local. But if you want people to know that that is a value for your restaurant, and you're competing with a restaurant that is also claiming to have so-and-so meat or such-and-such produce from a local farm that you know well, but you know they're not getting that, that is not only stealing from the farmer, that's a competitive disadvantage for you, isn't it?
Sure. I've been griping about that for 9 years.
You're probably thrilled to see this conversation.
Yeah, no, I was actually really thrilled to see this.
Because Art has made the point, and I'd like you to articulate it here for our listeners. If you put a farmer's name on your list, let's say you're getting meat from, you know, I'm thinking of local farms that you carry.
Seven Bridges,
right, which now, is in Avon?
Lima.
Yeah. Seven Bridges Farm. Meat from Seven Bridges Farm. So Lento carries Seven Bridges Farm. Right now, is there Seven Bridges Farm?
Picked it up this morning at the public market.
Okay, yeah. There you go. Other restaurants make the claim, and let's say they don't. What are the various concerns? What are the various negative impacts of putting the name like Seven Bridges, for an example, without actually carrying it?
Well, to the farmer, two things. One, someone could get sick if they're serving, you know, just some agri-farmed beef, and then they attribute it to Seven Bridges. You know, that's obviously terrible for business and bad PR that they don't deserve. And also, if they get a steak that's not so great, not of the highest quality, they're going to eat it, and they'll be like, I don't know why I paid all that money for that Seven Bridges steak. You know, that was nothing special, when what they ate was not a Seven Bridges steak, you know, that does a huge disservice to them as well.
So what should customers do? Art and Jerry say to ask questions about what local means to that particular restaurant because there's no legal standard. But if you ask, they should be able to tell you and provide a list of local farms.
Next up, the president of the Rochester School Board is pushing back against Mayor Lovely Warren's controversial proposal about how to help schools in trouble. The mayor wants to create a separate district for schools in receivership, and she wants control over who gets appointed to help revitalize those schools.
Board President Van White says this is divisive, and he joined Connections to elaborate on why he disagrees with the mayor.
I want to start by listening to some of what the mayor said last week on this program, and the first thing I want to clear up is some of the timeline. I did ask the mayor if she had let the school board president, Van White, know in advance that the proposal was coming and what you thought about it. Here is what Mayor Lovely Warren said about that.
Well, he and I had talked probably a couple months ago, not in depth, about this particular model. And I'm pretty sure he has some issues. He and I text last night. He's out of town. And I said when he gets back, we can talk about it more. But this is not a, this is not against a school board.
It doesn't sound like he's on board yet.
Well, I don't know.
All right, Van, so is what we just heard accurate?
Well, you know, let me first say she's an honorable person, a person who, if she tells me something, I have every reason to believe what she says. But I got to say, in this instance, her memory is not correct. And I don't want to get tied up in it because, you know, the fact is, as public officials, we have lots of conversations with lots of people, and they don't always take place in the best of circumstances where your ability to recall is exact. But I do need to say that we've never talked about any proposal that would involve receivership. The mayor being involved in receivership, any cluster of receivership schools. I mean, let me also say, she's not obligated. She wasn't obligated to share this with me. I just think it would have, when you're talking about relationships, whether it's mayor, school board, or mayor and governor, it's important to have comprehensive conversations so that people aren't caught off guard. And that's what happened here. So again, I don't challenge her integrity or her honesty, but I just have to make it clear that we had no conversation whatsoever about this. But that doesn't mean we can't have additional conversation. That's my intent. And let me also say, she and I have had what struck me about this and the reason why. She's absolutely correct about this. As soon as I found out about it, I was literally on the road. I think I was somewhere in Florida making my way back to Rochester. And as soon as someone sent me a link of the article, she's absolutely right. I texted her immediately. I said, "Lovely, what is this? Why wouldn't you tell me about it? Or if you didn't feel like strategically you could give me the actual proposal, why didn't you at least tell me that you had such grave concerns that you felt like you had to do something like this?" So this notion, and I'm not saying this is what she was saying, this notion that she wants to be at the table and she's not. If she wants to be at the table, and I believe she does, there are tables, plenty of tables for her to sit at, to discuss existing things that we are doing. We have a pattern of inviting people to the table because we realize we can't do it alone. And I would be concerned that her proposal would have her at one table and us at another table. And then I begin to wonder what happened to the slogan, One City.
Finally, let's hear from the political junkie.
NPR listeners know Ken Rudin from Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, a long-running feature. Ken joined us after the New York State presidential primary, which saw Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump dominate. Rudin says he's been wrong about Trump so far, but he now wonders if the Republican Party is about to nominate someone who can't win in November.
My gut tells me that he's going to have a big, big problem in November. I don't think any presidential candidate of either party has ever had such negatives going into a general election. But having said that, Evan, you make the point also that Hillary Clinton's negatives are high, too. She does very poorly among white men. She does considerably, not nearly as strong enough with white voters. Of course, she does very well with women, blacks and Latinos, yes. But she does have a lot of negatives. There are lingering questions about her honesty and credibility on many, many issues. So you have two candidates who are flawed, but I agree completely that I don't see how Donald Trump, given his history of some people will call it misogyny, but the things he said about women in the past, I don't know how you turn that around in November, especially with a group that is the majority of the American people.
That is Weekend Connections. You can hear Connections every weekday from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and Finger Lakes Public Radio WEOS 89.5 FM.
And you can always find us on the WXXI mobile app. From all of us at Connections, have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you Monday.